And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and I'm happy to have Hanan Tighe on the program today. His journalism has appeared in publications including Newsweek, The Wall Street Journal, New York Magazine, The San Francisco Chronicle, and The Jerusalem Post. He's also an assistant professor of creative writing at San Francisco State University. And today we'll be talking about his first book, The Lost Book of Moses, The Hunt for the World's Oldest Bible, which is now available in paperback from Echo HarperCollins.
The Lost Book of Moses opens in 1884 with a man named Moses Wilhelm Shapira dead from a gunshot wound to the head. You sure know how to set a dramatic tableau to open up a book, don't you?
Yeah, you know, it was funny. That's not actually how I originally began the book. I originally began somewhere much later on in the story. Then I turned in a draft to my editor, and a couple weeks later she came back to me and she said, you know, I got a great idea. I mean, what's more mysterious as far as opening a book than a dead body? So I said, you know what, God, you know, I had that original instinct to do that, and I thought, well, you know, I'm writing a book about the Bible. Maybe I don't need to start in the, you know, such a typical mystery way. And she said, but this is a mystery. And that was really important for me to hear, you know, and that's something I kept in my mind as I went back and edited and revised, that whatever this book may be about, it may be about the Bible, there may be elements of religion, elements of biblical criticism, information about Jerusalem in the 19th century. But at its core, it really is a mystery. And so I think ultimately that proved the perfect beginning for this book.
I checked your website, the faculty website you have at San Francisco State, and there's a different name for the book listed there. It hasn't been changed yet. And the title, The Book of Moses, really, there's a double meaning there because we have Moses, of course, who was supposed to have written the first five books of the Bible, and then we have a man named Moses who was peddling fragments of Deuteronomy.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the book was originally called Unholy Scriptures, Fraud, Suicide, Scandal, and the Bible that Rocked the Holy City, which is a very dramatic and Hollywood sort of title. But once again, my editor thought better of how I had initially approached it. She's very, very smart. The problem was I couldn't come up with an alternate title. So I'd been thinking about the book in those terms for so long that it was impossible for me to get beyond Unholy Scriptures as a title. And so I sent out an email to about five of my writer friends. And I said, guys, I got 2 days to come up with a title. Help me here. One of my friends, a poet who now teaches in Idaho, came back with, how about Lost Book of Moses? And I thought, oh my God, it's perfect. It works on every level. So we used that. And then between my editor and me, we came up with the subtitle, you know, The Hunt for the World's Oldest Bible.
And of course, it's not a complete Bible. These were just little leather fragments. They weren't even scrolls, as you say.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I used the word scrolls just because, think of the image it conjures up, Dead Sea Scrolls and Torah Scrolls and that sort of thing, which is what I want people picturing. Although what it in fact was 15 small strips of leather. They were about 7 inches long by about 3 inches tall. And they were not actually bound together in any way, like a Torah manuscript that one would read in a synagogue. They weren't, in fact, rolled up like we might picture a quote-unquote scroll, but there you have it. And then they weren't, frankly, the entire Bible. They represented a very strange and abridged version of the book of Deuteronomy, which is the fifth and final of the five books of Moses, in which Moses himself delivers his valedictory speech to the people of Israel in the desert before they cross into the land of Canaan, in which he recounts everything that's already happened to them. And then he goes off and essentially goes through a very, very long list in the traditional text of the Bible. It's something like 12 or 14 chapters long, list of rules, laws, statutes that the people of Israel will be expected to obey and live by once they do, in fact, cross into the land of Israel.
Kind of feels like going through TSA and going to the airport.
I suppose that's right. You know, although I've got TSA pre-check now. So it gets me through a little bit faster.
Fancy.
Yeah, I'm fancy schmancy now.
Also, it made me think of him, kind of the summary part of it makes me think of previously on Game of Bible.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, the idea, of course, being that the people who were actually getting to cross into the land of Israel were not, in fact, the children of Israel who left Egypt 40 years earlier. In fact, that was a sort of a punishment from God. The generation that left Egypt died off in the desert, and it was only a new generation, their children, their descendants, that actually got to cross into the promised land. And so as much as it's a recap for us as the reader, having read Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers previously, for them it wasn't so much of a repetition because, you know, they all hadn't been there at the very beginning. And so they didn't get to cross in, generation that left Egypt, and neither did Moses himself.
Now, when Shapira took these fragments to England, he treated them pretty cavalierly when he was showing them off to his potential buyers.
It's unbelievable to read the description of how he treated these manuscripts, which I should say he was asking from the British Museum £1 million in exchange for them. And £1 million in 1883, when this is all taking place, is worth something like $250 million today. No one had ever paid anything near that much for a piece of the past. The British Museum itself had recently paid £10,000 for something called the Gold Cup. And up to that point, that was the most they'd ever paid for a relic. And so £1 million was absolutely extraordinary. And so when he first brought them over, he brought them to the head of the Palestine Exploration Fund, a man named Sir Walter Besant, who was a very famous novelist at the time. And Besant set up a meeting of scholars, Hebrew teachers, and museum personnel. And they all met at the stroke of midnight in the summer of 1883. Shapira comes in. He's got a fancy carpet bag. He sticks his hand in. He pulls out these scrolls, these manuscripts, and he tosses them jauntily on the table, reports of the meeting indicate. And then he does a couple other things that, with our modern sensibilities, are just absolutely extraordinary. First is, no one could actually read the text. It was completely black. It was like looking at a burnt log. And so he pulls out a bottle of wine, a bottle of spirits, and pours some of the wine onto the manuscript, takes a little brush and starts scrubbing away. And what happened then was, for a brief moment, the action of the alcohol made visible letters that were sitting beneath the surface. And then as it dried up, they disappeared again. And so he'd pour more alcohol on it and scrub away again, and more letters became visible. That's, in fact, you know, how he initially came to figure out that he had the Book of Deuteronomy on his hands. He was able to transcribe it over the course of an entire month, pouring, scrubbing, reading, writing, pouring, scrubbing, reading, writing. And so that's what he did when he brought it in at that midnight meeting, and everyone was shocked by it. And then someone else asked a question about the nature of the leather. And even more remarkably than pouring alcohol on it, he grabs a piece, rips off the corner, and hands it to the man to feel it. The guy who was there said, this he did to a manuscript he claimed to be worth £1 million and 1,000 years old. People were shocked. But, you know, as shocking as it is to modern ears, the Dead Sea Scrolls, which were discovered years and years later, if you go back and look at photographs of how they were initially worked on by scholars, they're pictures of scholars using Scotch tape to tape them together while they were smoking. So they had cigarettes dangling out of their mouths over these extremely old, extremely valuable biblical documents, smoke pouring out, ash potentially dripping onto it, while taping them together with regular old Scotch tape. And so while Shapira's is maybe a little bit more shocking, even into the 40s and 50s, manuscripts like this were being treated in a fairly cavalier way.
Now, how old was he purporting these fragments to be?
You know, they were about 1,000 years older than any biblical manuscript that had at that time been discovered. So the Dead Sea Scrolls, which were from about the first century, hadn't yet been discovered. And so the idea was that these were from about the 9th century BC or BCE, approximately, you know, 832. And the way they determined that was there was another very important discovery made in 1868 in the same neck of the woods where Shapira's manuscripts were said to have been found. It was called the Mesha Stele, or the Moabite Stone. It was the first account of a biblical story ever discovered outside the Bible itself. And it was written in what they at the time called Phoenician, which is basically just ancient Hebrew. And Shapira's manuscripts were written in the exact same script that were used on the Mesha Stele. And so the idea was they knew the Mesha Stele was written about 830, 832. And so if it was written in the same script, then presumably Shapira's manuscript is also from around 830 or 832, making it wildly older than any biblical document that had been discovered up to that point.
And you talked about how it was an abridged version. And so the question is this older one a more accurate representation of how it was originally written, or is it a variation? There's a lot of scholarship that has to go into analyzing what it's actually saying. So how did it differ from what we know as the canonical Deuteronomy?
Yeah, I mean, you've put your finger on the thing that made the discovery of this document so controversial in 1883, which is the fact that it was very, very different from what's called the Masoretic text, or the traditional official text of the Bible that was used in synagogues and churches back then, much as it is today. And the idea was this. I mentioned earlier that in the Book of Deuteronomy, Moses spends several chapters talking about all the laws that the people of Israel are going to have to obey. All of that legal material is excised from Shapira's document. So all the laws, they're not there anymore. What does remain is the Ten Commandments, the kind of big ticket item in the book of Deuteronomy. But the Ten Commandments are actually different than the traditional Ten Commandments. A couple have been switched. Words have been moved here and there. Other laws from the book of Leviticus have been imported into the Ten Commandments. And so even the Ten Commandments are very different than what folks were used to. And so if the Ten Commandments can be changed, then for goodness sakes, what can't be changed? And people were up in arms about this because, as you indicated, if this was the oldest copy of the Bible in the world, as people were positing back then, they were even thinking maybe Moses himself had written this very copy of Deuteronomy. Maybe this was the original copy of Deuteronomy. Well, if it was that old and that different than what they were reading in synagogues and churches, then what they were reading in synagogues and churches was in its way a fraud. If the oldest and hence most original copy of the Bible was different, then what they were reading now was not in fact what God handed over to Moses, you know, on Sinai all those years ago. And that was a very controversial idea back then, because what it indicated was that the Bible had changed over the course of the years. Who changed it? Well, obviously man would have to be involved. And that was a shocking proposal in the late 19th century. To our ears now, it's not necessarily shocking. But when Shapira brought these manuscripts to London in 1883, this was very, very new. There was a cadre of Protestant, sort of mostly German theologians at the time, who were beginning to do what is now called biblical criticism, where they're approaching the Bible the way literary scholars would approach, you know, Shakespeare or Melville. And they were beginning to come up with theories about how, in fact, the Torah, the five books of Moses, had developed. And their theories were not that God had handed it down word for word to Moses on Sinai or elsewhere, but rather that it had begun as a series of disparate books that had been edited together by what these scholars began to call redactors or editors. And what was interesting about Shapira's manuscript was that in some cases, the differences in his manuscript actually proved potentially correct what these scholars were saying. In other cases, it made it seem like some of their arguments were incorrect. And so everyone was able to read into Shapira's document whatever they wanted to read into it. But in any case, it was entirely controversial, and he very, very quickly became, you know, a household name. He was reported on in newspapers. They wrote about him under their literary gossip moniker. He became a very desired dinner guest. Back home in Jerusalem, his wife and daughter were blowing all sorts of money on credit because they were about to become the richest family in Jerusalem. And even the Prime Minister of England, a man named William Ewart Gladstone, shows up at the British Museum to meet their honored guests from Jerusalem and to see what, in fact, he'd brought along with him. And remarkably, you know, people were educated in such a way at that time that Gladstone was actually able to look at the document, was actually able to read this Phoenician or ancient Hebrew, and was so amazed by what he saw that he himself is said to have gone out and started raising the £1 million sterling on his own to make sure that England didn't lose out on this incredible discovery to either France or Germany, to whom they lost out on prior discoveries from the sands of the Middle East.
Because it had only been for about a period of 100 years that the search for antiquities by European countries really began. So we go like back to the Elgin Marbles and Napoleon looting of Mediterranean art and history. And so, of course, they start off with classical civilizations, then they move back into biblical times. So talk about this Moabitica.
So again, Shapira couldn't have brought this manuscript to England at a better time for himself, which is to say the people of England and Europe at the time were primed for such a discovery. And that's because, as you say, the field of archaeology had only just recently emerged, and the field of biblical archaeology in particular was beginning to excite the cream of European society. And so that, along with this development of biblical criticism, along with improvements in transportation like the steamship and train travel, allowed foreign visitors from Europe and the United States to start descending on Jerusalem and start with a Bible in one hand and a spade in the other. That was sort of a popular sobriquet for these folks. They had come to Jerusalem not only to walk in the footsteps of Jesus, but to dig in the sands where Jesus had walked and see if they might not be able to discover something that A, could prove the Bible right, or B, at least take home a piece of the place where the Bible took place. And so Shapira shows up with these manuscripts right when all of this is happening. People are, of course, obviously enthralled. Now, you mentioned the Moabitica. Before Shapira showed up at the British Museum with these biblical manuscripts, he had become famous for selling to Prussia or Germany about 2,000 pieces of what they called Moabitica, which was statues and other clay relics that were purportedly from Moab, which was a biblical people and territory east of the Dead Sea. And it was a very mysterious people. The Bible said very little about them or their culture or customs. And yet, here comes Shapira with thousands upon thousands of relics of material history depicting what, in fact, the Moabite culture was like. And these were fascinating pieces. I mean, some of them were very, very grotesque looking faces, distended faces, people with beaks, that sort of thing. Others of them were sort of a very sexual nature, which honestly, if you look at them, they'd be shocking today. So they were certainly shocking in the late 19th century. In any event, Shapira sells these to the government of Prussia, and they are very, very excited by this discovery. And then, not long after he makes his second big sale to the German government, a French archaeologist by the name of Charles Clermont-Ganneau comes out and begins writing a series of blistering articles attacking the Moabitica, claiming it's fraudulent. Shapira is sort of very upset by this and fights back in the press. But after a number of years of back and forth, it becomes clear that, in fact, this Moabitica was fake. And Shapira says, well, I didn't do it. If anything, I was the dupe. A bunch of Bedouin brigands had sort of brought it to him bagful by bagful, and he just believed that it was authentic because that's what they told
Salim.
Him. Yeah, exactly. You know, you mentioned Salim, that's sort of his agent or his factotum, as they referred to him back then, and he was the link between the Bedouin and Shapira. As it turned out, he may in fact have been the one doing the forging of these pieces of Moabite pottery himself. Whoever in fact did them, Shapira claimed it wasn't him, but he had egg all over his face. The German government had egg all over their faces, and it put Shapira in a very, very precarious situation, both as far as his reputation and financially. So he needed something that would dig him out of this financial hole and that would reestablish his reputation, because he was a man who badly, badly wanted the approval of the scholarly world. You know, he saw himself as a scholar, although he wasn't officially educated as such. He didn't have a PhD. He was probably educated in a yeshiva back home in the Pale of Settlement before he immigrated to Jerusalem, at which point he was a Jew. But somewhere between the Pale of Settlement and Jerusalem, he converted to Christianity.
Before this incident starts, he had had a tremendously interesting life leading up to then.
He had indeed. As I say, he was born in a place called Kamenets-Podolsk, which at times in its history has been part of Russia, Poland, or Lithuania. He left there chasing after his father, who had gone off to the Holy Land. So he and his grandfather took off trying to find the father, but along the way, his grandfather dies. And so he's left all alone in the world with, you know, a father somewhere in the Holy Land, a grandfather dead, nothing to return to back home. And so you could see why a kind of lonely nomad at this point might find solace in the words of Jesus. And so some missionaries in Bulgaria start talking to him about the gospel and explaining to him what they see as the truth. And lo and behold, he converts to Christianity. And so when he arrives in Jerusalem in around 1856, all of a sudden, he is a Christian. Now, the cynical people can look at that and say, well, yeah, sure, he says that he had an honest conversion because of a change in beliefs. But in fact, in Jerusalem, in the mid-19th century and up through the late 19th century, to be a Jew was, in fact, a fairly unattractive proposition. That sounds difficult to imagine, you know, using modern ears. But back then, Jews were very much at the bottom of the socioeconomic totem pole in Jerusalem.
Because the Ottoman Empire was running things.
The Ottoman Empire was running things. You know, even the Christians in Jerusalem were at a significantly higher socioeconomic level, A, because they brought with them funds from Europe, and because they had access to church funds coming in from Europe. And so there's a question as to whether or not Shapira's conversion was in fact an honest conversion or was actually, you know, made out of more material concerns. But there's no question that he remained a Christian to the end of his life. People heaped scorn on him for this, so the guy couldn't win.
You know, he was between worlds.
He was really caught between worlds. It was a sort of purgatory for him because the Jews in Jerusalem where he lived despised apostates. You know, in fact, apostates were punished. Jews who had anything to do with the Protestant community, for example, if you went and sought medical treatment at a Protestant hospital, you could be excommunicated. On the other hand, the Christians didn't trust him either. I remember a letter from someone from the Palestine Exploration Fund when Shapira discovered this Moabitica. They said, well, it's all very interesting, but his being a converted Jew goes very much against us believing that this stuff is in fact accurate. And so Christians didn't trust him, Jews didn't like him, and he was stuck in this middle place, trying to claw his way out.
Now, in addition to Charles Clément Ganom, there was another man who very much thought critically of the scripture fragments, and that was Christian Ginzburg, who was another man who had converted from Judaism to Christianity.
Interesting, right? His name, he was born David Ginzburg in Warsaw on Christmas Day, in fact, and I think it was 1831. And at about the age of 15, he also, through meetings he had with missionaries, began to believe in the Gospels and converted. You know, again, this is one of those things that a lot of people, not too many people, but a lot more people, I think, were doing that in that day than do today. And a lot of them in Europe ended up in the sphere of the British Museum. They had all of these skills, having grown up Jewish, gone to yeshivas, they read Hebrew, they knew the Bible, they knew the Talmud. And yet their religious beliefs had changed, but they were able to put those skills garnered as kids to work. And Christian David Ginzburg was, in fact, one of the great Bible scholars of the day. And when Shapira shows up in London in the summer of 1883 with his supposed book of Deuteronomy, the British Museum calls in Christian David Ginzburg to transcribe and translate this mysterious document to see, in fact, what they have on their hands and if they should actually pay £1 million sterling for it. And Ginzburg takes the document from Shapira and he runs over to the manuscript room at the British Museum. And for about 4 weeks, he toils away, you know, much like Shapira had, working, trying to figure out what he had on his hands. In a letter to his daughter, he says, "This job has ruined my eyesight completely because of the difficulties that I described earlier in reading the document." But after 4 weeks, Ginzburg, and this is while Shapira is being celebrated all over the world, and particularly in London, Ginzburg comes out after 4 weeks and says, "Hold your horses, everybody. You know, these manuscripts are a fake. They're a fraud." And everyone is really disappointed. This has excited a lot of people. No one, of course, is more disappointed than Shapira himself. And he takes off on a six-month bender in Europe where he writes letters and never mails them, and he leaves pieces of luggage behind in, you know, each city he visits. And ultimately, he ends up taking a small room in a really seedy hotel in Rotterdam in the Netherlands. And in March of 1884, he shoots himself in the head, dies of suicide, because he was so distraught by having been outed as a fraud by Christian David Ginzburg, a man who he had known for years and years.
He gave it away. I'm cutting that part out.
Well, there was, you know, that was one of the challenges in writing this book, is that the chapters alternate between the historical story of Shapira and the current day story of my own hunt in 8 countries on 4 continents over the course of about 5 years for Shapira's missing manuscript. So one of the challenges for me writing the book was that in order for anyone to care about my own search for the Bible, they had to understand a few things already. One of which was, you know, what was this Bible? 2, I think, was that Shapira had been so distraught over it being outed as a fraud that he ended his life. And 3 was, you know, that it was, in fact, determined to be fake and disappeared. And so, you know, I had to figure out, how do I tell the story in a way where I have to give away the punchline, basically, somewhere toward the beginning for anyone to care about the rest of what I was writing? And so that was a balancing act that I was, you know, struggling with the whole way through.
Now, it was because of a biblical scholar that you even heard of Shapira in the first place, your father.
Yes, in fact, it was my father. That's right. My dad is a Bible scholar and a rabbi, and his great work to date is a commentary on the book of Deuteronomy, the very book that got Shapira in so much trouble. Now, my dad spent 16 years writing his commentary on Deuteronomy. It's about 600 pages long. And for me, the word Deuteronomy was like the word peanut butter and jelly in most normal households, which is to say, I heard it every single day growing up. I probably said it every single day growing up. We talked about Deuteronomy. We thought about Deuteronomy. We wondered how far along in his commentary on Deuteronomy my father was. And so over dinner one Friday night about 6 or 7 years ago, I had recently written a series of articles about the discovery of Noah's Ark. You know, they discover Noah's Ark every year, and it never turns out to be, in fact, Noah's Ark. So there had been another Noah's Ark discovery hoax, and I was telling my family about this discovery and then about its subsequent debunking. And my father said, you know, hey, you want to hear a real biblical mystery? And he began telling me this story about this man named Shapira who had brought a supposedly ancient copy of Deuteronomy to the British Museum, asking £1 million for it. And it ultimately ended up being debunked in the late 19th century and led to Shapira's death. Well, I'm an investigative reporter, and I'm already primed to be interested in anything to do with the Book of Deuteronomy. And so I was immediately hooked on this.
But you found out you were far from the only one that was interested in Shapira as a subject.
Yeah, that was initially disappointing. I remember thinking, this is perfect. I'm fascinated. I'm going to track down this Bible. I'm going to find the missing Bible. And I am going to prove whether or not this was real or fake, whether Shapira had discovered the first Dead Sea Scroll or whether this was something else entirely. But as I began searching, I quickly learned that there was this sort of subculture of people who called themselves Shapira maniacs, people who were out there doing the exact same thing, and some of them who had been doing it for literally decades. In particular, there was an Israeli filmmaker who had been researching Shapira for 30 years. And I remember when I met him and he started telling me this, I just thought, oh, no. You know, if he's been at it for 30 years, there is no way on earth I can possibly catch up. And I remember I mentioned this to my uncle, who's a journalist, and he said to me, you know, if he's been at it for 30 years and hasn't found it yet, I think you're probably going to be able to catch up to him. And so that gave me a little bit of solace. But then I met with this documentary filmmaker and we discussed potentially working together. He said he had 6 clues that were going to lead him to the missing manuscript. And that just was sort of, that was like crack cocaine for me, you know. It was just addictive to hear 6 clues. What were they? And I was like, can you tell me what the clues are? And he said, well, and he hemmed and hawed, and he thought about, well, maybe I could give you the clues if your book was suddenly written by Hanan, Tige, and me. But for a variety of reasons, I couldn't do that, you know, not least of which was that I already had a contract and couldn't change things. So ultimately, we couldn't work together. I don't want to get into too many details here, but it turned out that, you know, after that, he not only didn't want to help me anymore, but made major strides in trying to prevent me from getting anywhere further with my search so that he could be the one to, you know, get to the goal line first.
It almost sounds as intriguing as all the skullduggery back in Shapira's time, because Ginsberg and Ganot, even though they both had denounced the scrolls, hated each other famously.
Just as today there is crazy politics and competition among scholars of the same subject, that was certainly the case back then. So I already talked about Ginsberg coming out and saying that Shapira's manuscripts were a fraud. Well, that was the official death knell for the manuscript. Several days earlier, this French archaeologist, Charles Clermont-Ganneau, who had earlier debunked Shapira's Moabite pottery, the Moabitica, he came out and in the pages of a number of prominent English publications, declared for himself that Shapira's manuscripts were fraudulent. Years later, after Ginsberg had died, his son began writing in newspapers that Ganot had come to visit his father in the British Museum several days before Ginsberg himself came out with his verdict. Ginsberg had shared his information with Ganot as a scholarly courtesy, and then Ganot, the younger Ginsberg said, had gone off, stolen all of Ginsberg's theories, printed them as his own so that he could be the first to debunk Shapira's manuscript. This, of course, very, very much upset Ginsberg. And when Ganot, after Shapira's death, came back to the British Museum to see if he might get a second look at these manuscripts, Ginsberg burst in white in the face and furious and had him thrown out of the museum. And so this competition, as far as looking for and investigating Shapira's manuscripts, certainly didn't start with me.
But you could see why Yoram Sabo, the filmmaker, might be reticent to share any information with you in light of that story.
Absolutely. And, you know, the fact was, as much as I wanted this guy Sabo to share his information with me, in fact, I was desperate for him to share his information with me. I had a book contract, and I was running into brick wall after brick wall and was really failing in my search for a while. So as much as I wanted him and needed him to share the information with me, when he didn't, I understood completely, because the fact was, if our roles had been reversed, I'd like to think I'd be the nice guy and share it with him, but I can't imagine I would have.
Now, you mentioned that you traveled so many places to look for information about Shapira and the Skrulls, and that you ended up in Australia, and that's about as far away from the Middle East as I would presume you could be.
I never in a million years expected that the search would take me to half the places it ended up taking me. I was in Israel, Jordan, Germany, France, the Netherlands, England, and as you say, Australia. That was certainly the most unexpected stop on my tour. And I should back up, because what I realize I haven't said yet was that after Shapira died, his Skrulls had mysteriously disappeared. So no one knew what happened to them after. What happened was something along these lines. You fast forward 70 years from Shapira's death to the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, which are considered by some to be the greatest archaeological discovery, certainly Near Eastern archaeological discovery of the 20th century. Now, Shapira in the 19th century had claimed that his copy of Deuteronomy had been discovered by Bedouin somewhere near the Dead Sea in caves. It was the Book of Deuteronomy, and they were full of variant readings from the traditional text, as I said. Well, in 1947, the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered, which were biblical manuscripts, Deuteronomy, one of the most popular among this cache of new biblical discoveries. They were discovered by Bedouin wandering near the Dead Sea in caves and full of variant readings on the traditional text of Deuteronomy. And so many scholars, remembering Shapira, thought, my God, he discovered the first Dead Sea Scroll 7 decades before the rest of them were discovered, and was pushed toward death because this discovery was so far ahead of its time that people simply couldn't bring themselves to believe it had been true. So they said, well, we better go back and look at these manuscripts and see if in fact they were real, or if Shapira had, as they thought in the late 19th century, forged them. And so they went back to look for them, but they were gone. They'd vanished. They had simply dropped off the face of the earth, and no one had the vaguest notion what happened to them. And that's where I came into the story, and several other people came into the story, as it turned out. You know, I decided I wanted to be the one to find what had happened to them after they vanished in the 1800s. Now, one theory actually involved an Australian man. His name was Sir Charles Nicholson. He owned several manuscripts that Shapira had once owned, which is to say he bought a few copies of the Torah from Shapira. He was very much specifically interested in the Book of Deuteronomy. Some of his notebooks, which folks have looked at, including me, include his copying passages from Deuteronomy into them as an old man, you know, in his 80s and 90s. And interestingly, his estate in northern London went up in flames in 1899. And so the thinking on this theory was this man, Sir Charles Nicholson, had probably bought Shapira's scrolls because he'd bought other scrolls and he was interested in Deuteronomy, so why wouldn't he? And now we know why they disappeared, because his study went up in flames, so clearly it was reduced to ash in that fire. Now, as it turns out, that wasn't true at all. And also, weirdly, as it turns out, that man, Nicholson, though he was Australian, that had nothing to do with my ending up in Australia. I don't want to give away too much, except to say that I got a mysterious email from a man in Sydney, Australia at one point. This was years into my search, who said, you know, something along the lines of, Dear Hanan, I've been working on the Shapira story for quite a while too. And as it happens, I discovered what happened to Shapira's scrolls after the last time anyone ever saw them. And then I wrote him back and I said, well, I'd like you to tell me what happened to Shapira's scrolls after the last time anyone ever saw them. And then this man, and a man named Matthew Hamilton in Sydney, Australia, proceeded to, like Shapira's scrolls, drop off the face of the planet entirely.
Radio silence.
Radio silence. I heard nothing more from him. Over the course of 8 months, I sent him a series of increasingly desperate emails. You know, look, I needed to turn my book in, and I had no ending. Frankly, I had almost no beginning. And I desperately needed this information from him.
And I think we should leave it there
and
to
we
keep
leave
the,
it there.
The mystery intact, at least on that part of it.
All right. I like how you roll.
Now, since the publication of the hardcover early in 2016, has anybody come across with new information, or have you dug up any more information that will appear in the paperback version?
The short answer is no. Now, no one has come to me with any further information. Frankly, I don't think there is any further information. But also at a certain point, that point being publication of the book, I decided I was done searching. I really think I discovered the truth about what happened to these scrolls and whether or not they were real or fake. And I don't actually even know where I would look next. I really feel like I've exhausted all the options and know what happened.
Have you had any feedback from the Shapiro Maniac community?
I have, yeah. Specifically, Matthew Hamilton in Sydney, Australia. I'll tell you, one of the things I was most worried about here, you know, my dad's a Bible scholar, so I was able to have him really help me fact check all the biblical stuff here. You always want someone who's an expert, you know, more expert than you are, looking at these things. And so he and a number of other people were able to help me fact check all the stuff on that side of things. But what that left was the story of the people I was writing about. And while I was confident about all the facts I was reporting, you never know how a person is going to react to how you portray them. And one thing I found as a journalist is that people react completely opposite from how you think they're going to. So if you present someone in what you think is the most laudatory, lovely way, sometimes they'll come back to you and they'll be upset about something you said. You know, they'll say, like, I didn't wear a shirt with a big collar. And you'll say, why are they attacking me about this? And then you write about someone else and you feel like, I'm really sticking it to this guy because he deserves it. And he'll come back to you and say, oh, you got me perfectly. You really, really portrayed me exactly right. You never know how anyone's going to respond. So I was particularly concerned with how Matthew Hamilton in Australia was going to take what I wrote. Not because I wrote anything bad about him. In fact, quite the opposite. He was a lovely, brilliant guy. But you just never know how someone's going to respond. And thankfully, you know, he wrote back after having read the book, before I even got a chance to send it to him myself as a thank you. He'd, I think, you know, purchased it online and read it. And he just said the nicest things. And it kind of, you know, it really, you know, made my week, certainly. And it put to bed one of my biggest concerns in publishing the book.
Now, before undertaking this project, did you know about yourself that you had this capacity for obsession?
No, not at all. And I often think if I'd known what it was going to take to ultimately carry this search out to the end and write the book about it, would I have done it? You know, I'd like to think the answer is yes. But I didn't know I had it in me. But here's the thing, you know, I quickly realized that every time I hit a brick wall in this search, my instinct wasn't to give up and throw in the towel, although occasionally it occurred to me, you know, when I was sort of sitting around eating Fruity Pebbles out of a large salad bowl in my couch and being depressed. But my instinct wasn't to give up. My instinct was to try to break through that wall, to try to go around that wall, to try to find another wall to scale. So whenever I failed at finding the document in a place that I'd thought it might be and hoped it might be, I quickly went back to the drawing board and said, okay, well, if it's not there, then what else could make sense? What do the facts show me? Where are the facts leading me other than this place? And so I always made sure not to put all my eggs in one basket, as it were. I was always kind of working on multiple levels so that I wouldn't get to the point where I had no further doors to knock on. But of course, it would have been easy enough to simply not knock on any of those further doors. But that's the thing about obsession is it's not something you can control. You don't say, I'm going to be obsessed with this, or I'm going to be obsessed with that, or I'm not going to be obsessed with this. It's uncontrollable. It's just something inside you. The brain either works that way or it doesn't work that way. In some ways, I think, thank God, my brain does work that way because I had the most phenomenal time doing this. I learned such an incredible amount, and I enjoyed it so much. My only concern is, you know, what's the next thing I'm going to become obsessed with, and can my savings account handle it?
And can your family put up with it?
That's right. Well, I'll tell you, that's an interesting point you make because, you know, my wife is a writer. She's a short story writer and novelist named Molly Antipole, and she knows exactly what goes into the making of a book, to the writing of a book. And so I traveled endlessly. It was very expensive. I went repeatedly to all sorts of crazy places. And because she knows what it's like to be obsessed with a project like this, because she knows what goes into writing a book, she never once questioned, you know, are you sure you need to be going to Australia right now? Or, you know, you think going to Jordan right now is a great idea? Or have you looked at our bank account lately? And that never once happened. So I was actually incredibly lucky on that front. You know, I had extreme support from my parents, obviously, who were involved in the project in a very sort of tactile way, as we've already described, and from my wife, who was absolutely supportive at every step along the way.
Well, Hanan, I want to thank you so much for coming in today and sharing the search with us.
Thank you so much. It's good to be here in Memphis.
Hanan Tighe is the author of The Lost Book of Moses, The Hunt for the World's Oldest Bible, which is now available in paperback from Echo HarperCollins. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WIPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.